From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, how Dan Gilbert's Bedrock team pushed back against state safety inspectors after they cited a Bedrock building for safety violations.
Bedrock executives conducted the meeting at the front of the room and told the inspectors that a policy on construction work sites did not apply to them.
Could the state's new A through F school grading law break federal law?
The state law excludes schools, and federal law says that all schools have to be included.
It's the last January for the North American International Auto Show.
I think it's going to feel like it's going out with a bit of a whimper.
And happy 60th birthday, Motown Records.
Who knew 60 years ago, you know, that something that historical and magical was taking place, you know, right here in Detroit in a little house on the boulevard.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In the frantic bill passing of lame duck, the state legislature pushed through an A through F grading system for Michigan schools. It requires the state to grade K through 12 schools in five areas and make the grades available for parents to review. Former Governor Snyder signed the bill into law December 28th, despite vigorous objections and criticisms from many in the education community, including interim state school superintendent Sheila Alice. She's now seeking a legal review of this grading system law. Sheila, welcome.
Thank you, Cindy. It's wonderful to be with you.
In your letter to the Michigan Senate, you wrote this plan, and I'm quoting here, undermines years of investment and stakeholder input. Can you tell us what you meant by that statement?
I'd be happy to. When the U.S. Department of Education has required states to create an accountability system, one of the requirements in the creation of that accountability system, Cindy, is to have stakeholder input into your accountability system. And so the Michigan Department of Education spent a significant amount of time garnering input from a variety of different stakeholders across the state. And that input was then used to create our current accountability system, which meets federal requirements. We, MDE, included such a significant number of different stakeholders in the creation of our federal accountability system that we were recognized at the national level for our stakeholder involvement. And that's what I was referencing in that quote that you read from my letter to the Senate.
And you're voicing concern the law could violate both the state's federally approved education plan as well as federal law. So take us more deeply into that. How so?
In federal law, specifically in the Individuals with Disability Education Act, otherwise known as IDEA, there is a violation of IDEA because the current legislation excludes some public schools that meet specific requirements that are in legislation. And IDEA says that all schools must be included in the state's accountability system. That's one area in which we believe is a violation of IDEA. And that is that the state law excludes schools, and federal law says that all schools have to be included. There are conflicts with the Every Student Succeeds Act, otherwise known as ESSA, and where there are some conflicts with ESSA has to do with certain subgroups that the state law is allowing to be excluded, or certain groups of students that the state law indicates that can be excluded from counting them. And ESSA says that you must include all students and you cannot exempt any students.
Which students?
It indicates students who are chronically absent, students who are eligible for special education programs. So when you look at some of these areas in the law, the state law, that says these students do not have to be counted or do not have to be included, what ESSA would say is, no, you must include all students. And specifically, the ones that I'm looking at are those that are eligible for special education services. State law says that those students, if they meet certain criteria, can be excluded. And process says that we have to include all of our students. And so we include all of our students when we created our state accountability system that meets federal requirements.
The superintendent of the Detroit Public Schools Community District, Nikolai Vitti, was on Stateside blasting this plan the day it passed and pointing out it derailed months of work that the district had put into creating its own A through F school grading system, which it was ordered to do by the state. What are you hearing from other superintendents across Michigan about what this new grading law will mean at the district level?
I have received phone calls and emails from superintendents that are looking for a response from the department because they have grave concerns about the current legislation in that it will create two accountability systems. We would maintain our current federal accountability system through ESSA, and then it would create a state accountability system. Not only would we have two accountability systems, which certainly would be confusing, but we would also have two systems in which schools are identified for needing improvement or needing support. And so you could have a set of schools that are identified through the federal accountability system that are in need of additional support and intervention, and then a separate set of schools through the state's accountability system that would be identified for intervention and support. Because while there are similarities and there's alignment between some components of the federal accountability system and the state's accountability system, there are some differences which would then yield a different set of schools to be identified for intervention and support, which is known at the federal level as CSI schools, Comprehensive Support and Intervention Schools.
So that could certainly set up some hair-pulling moments for superintendents and administrators.
It will be confusing, exasperating, and frustrating for superintendents.
I'm speaking with Interim State School Superintendent Sheila Alice as we talk about the new A through F grading system that was signed into law by former Governor Snyder December 28th. They are now asking for a legal review of this grading system. We've got, as you point out, all of these interventions, the accountability measures, this new grading system. Yet schools, even though they've had a lot of changes in the last several years with this, they're still falling behind other states in academic performance. Are these ever-changing reforms actually helping our schools?
You hit the nail right on the head when you said these ever-changing reforms, Cindy. And because we move the goalpost on our schools and our districts on a regular basis because of state legislation, schools and districts don't have an opportunity to implement their intervention plans to be successful because we are changing the rules and we're changing the game on them. And so they feel that frustration because they're responding to changes in legislation and feel that many times the rug's being pulled out from underneath them because they have a plan in place to address areas in which they struggle, and then the legislation changes and they have to then make changes at a district and school level. And because of that constant churning of change, that we don't have consistency when our schools and districts are attempting to implement changes that are going to make a difference in student learning.
You were at the first meeting of the new State Board of Education on Tuesday night. Certainly the A through F system came up. What's the board's response? And I'm wondering, was it a bipartisan response?
It was not a bipartisan response. It was a unanimous response on the part of the State Board of Education. And they also have grave concerns about the A to F system and have given their support of me reaching out to the Attorney General's office to get guidance from the Attorney General's office on next steps in going forward. We are also reaching out to the U.S. Department of Education and asking guidance from them.
How long do you think it'll take before you get that opinion, get those opinions?
Well, I'm not asking for a formal opinion. I'm asking for guidance. And so from the Michigan Attorney General's office, I'm not sure how long it will take. We were told from the federal U.S. Department of Ed that it could take months before we get a response.
What do you feel, Sheila Alice, would be the consequences if Michigan goes ahead with this A through F grading law as it's currently written?
If we go ahead with the state's, the A to F that's in the state legislation, and we abandoned our federal accountability, approved federal accountability system, which is called our index system, which has been available for schools and districts and parents and communities for the last 2 years. We would run the risk of losing federal funds, and that would include losing our funds for special education services, as well as losing our title funds that we receive from the federal government. So we would be talking about a significant loss of funding.
There has been a real push for a while to make it easier for parents to understand school rankings. So if it isn't this A through F plan, what would you prefer to see?
I would prefer that we use what we currently have available, and that is our accountability system that meets federal law. It's called our index system, and it's available on the MDE website, and it links to each school, and it provides information for parents on student proficiency in EL, English Language Arts, and math on state assessments. It provides information for parents on the growth that students are making in ELA and math on state assessments. It provides information about the graduation rate of each individual school. It provides information about English learners' progress on state assessments. And it also provides information about additional programs and services that schools provide for their students. And so that information is available on the myschooldata.org website. And so I think that we have a very comprehensive system for providing information to parents, a dashboard system for providing information to parents that they could use if they wanted to see how their child's or children's school is doing, as well as if they wanted to look at other schools in the area or other schools across the state.
Interim State School Superintendent Sheila Ellis, we want to thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for this opportunity to share our reaction to the A to F legislation. Greatly appreciate it.
Coming up, looks like teens now care a whole lot less about cigarettes and a whole lot more about vaping.
If you were going to smoke a cigarette, you'd have to, in school, find some place to go light up, and then you'd have to spend a considerable amount of time finishing off the cigarette. Whereas with Juul, you take a hit and you put it back in your pocket.
Vaping is becoming so popular among teens, the FDA and Surgeon General call it an epidemic. We'll learn more in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The very final North American International Auto Show to be held in the depths of winter will kick off in a few days. It's a turning point in the history of Detroit's auto extravaganza. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. And, you know, I think about it, Daniel, for some of us, it's kind of hard to believe it has been 30 years since the Detroit Auto Show got amped up to the North American International Auto Show. All things must change, though.
Yes, and this is definitely a change. I think it's going to feel like it's going out with a bit of a whimper. You look at the press conference schedule, who's going to be here, and it's astonishing, frankly. It essentially is going to be over by midday on Monday. There's only one event on Sunday night. Used to be Sundays were packed, basically from noon to 6 o'clock. General Motors is holding a single event for the Cadillac brand on Sunday night, and that's it.
Wow.
And then we amp up on Monday morning, but I think amping is too strong of a word. There's a few things that are going to be going on, but clearly this show and auto shows in general are changing. They are not mandatory on the schedule for the industry anymore. Industry executives don't feel like they need to be there, and frankly, it's turning more towards consumer shows and away from being an industry show and a media show. I exchanged emails with an old colleague of mine who writes for Handelsblatt, which is the Wall Street Journal of Germany, and asked him about it. He said, yeah, we're not going. We'll be at CES in Las Vegas. The German automakers were there, rolled out some big things this week, but nothing in Detroit.
Why are we seeing this? Because you note in your column, this is really kind of happening with auto shows elsewhere in the U.S. and in Europe. How come?
Well, I think there's a lot of different things that are driving it. One of it is cost. I mean, automakers have historically spent a lot of money on auto shows. But as they as technology has evolved and you have the ability to reach select audiences very tightly with through digital technologies and the internet and things like that, people are using that, and it is, in general, is a lot less expensive. A press conference at a major auto show could cost $500,000 to throw, and a thing only lasts 15, 25 minutes. Whereas if you do a product reveal like Ford did last night of the Explorer at Ford Field, it could cost half that, you know, $200,000, $100,000 to have a big event. You have everybody focused on your product. You're not competing with the Ram over here and the Jeep in 10 minutes and the Toyota in 25 minutes and the Volkswagen. You have a captive audience. And I think they find that they have a much greater return on their investment, and the investment is actually less. The other thing is the industry is in a real state of flux now. People are very focused on traditional cars and trucks, particularly SUVs in the U.S. market, but there's a lot of technology. There's a lot of talk of hybrid vehicles and certainly autonomous vehicles. They're not ready to really show that stuff.
Daniel, what do we know about what the auto show is going to look like next year? What it'll look like, how it will happen? And the fact we know it's going to be in June, so nobody will be sloshing through snow.
Right. So we're off about an 18-month hiatus, whatever, however that math works out, roundabout. It's going to be in Kobo, anchored in Kobo. I would expect it's going to be smaller, like this current show. They are talking with the German automakers, trying to get them to come back. The Germans have not committed. I would be astonished if they're back the first year. I think there's some things that need to happen, obviously. A lot of things can happen in the industry. There's a lot of churn right now going on. People are, you know, restructuring, talking about killing various products, maybe closing a plant, taking out salaried workforce. I mean, that's happening all around the world in various ways. So I think we've got to see how that plays out and also how the economic environment plays out before they're going to make some of those decisions. And then some of it is going to be more experiential outside. As I recall, they're going to have down around Hart Plaza, they're going to have an area that's essentially fenced off, meaning you can't get into it as a member of the public unless you have a ticket.
Meantime, talk to us about the news coming out of Ford. What are you hearing?
Mm-hmm. Well, they had a press conference this morning. I think my colleague had to be on a call at 5 a.m. to talk about a restructuring of Europe, which we knew was coming. We've known a lot of these things are coming. I think I would expect we're going to see something about the Ford in South America as well. Europe's a bit of a bigger deal. They're going to be doing similar things that they've sort of announced in North America, which is on the product side, they're going to rationalize their product lineup, get out of things that they feel are not profitable and are not going to be profitable. They may be taking some plant actions and some salaried workforce actions. It is very, very difficult to close manufacturing facilities in Western Europe. Very difficult and very expensive, particularly in France and Germany. I suspect that they've just recently taken an action on a plant they have in Bordeaux. They have a couple of other plants in Germany. It's interesting to note Ford, the Blue Oval, is the market leader in the UK, and they do not produce cars in the UK. Brexit comes in March, and I think there's some real concern about what that might do. Now, the fact that Ford is not producing in Britain is probably a good thing, because if they were, I think that plant might be imperiled by Brexit, depending on how the details all shake out. So I think this is a presage of what we're going to see probably in the second quarter in the U.S. We've been talking about General Motors over the last month or so, and it's not just going to be a GM story. It's going to be a GM and a Ford story.
With jobs and with effect jobs in North America as well.
Yes. I would expect with Ford in North America, the plant actions are going to be less extensive than they are with General Motors. There's no question that General Motors has a lot more unused capacity, plant capacity, than Ford. Ford has been very good at managing their plant capacity usage in the United States. As a result, the likelihood that they're going to have to go into negotiations next year and ask for or try to get some actions on plants is, I think, dramatically diminished at Ford compared to General Motors. That's going to be a very tough negotiation, both in the U.S. and in Canada.
And then briefly, what can you tell us about these reports about Ford and VW making some kind of big announcement?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of 2+2=5 here. This is an open secret that these two companies are having these negotiations and these discussions, I should say, about a potential alliance over commercial vehicles, autonomous vehicle development, development, potentially small cars in Europe, and potentially a Volkswagen brand vehicles produced in Ford factories in the United States, which would also be a net positive for the UAW. It is entirely possible there could be an announcement of some kind or talking about some things that they have sorted out. I think we've been cautioned against coming to a conclusion that this would be the big grand announcement of this is what we're going to do. I continue to be very skeptical of this, not that it's going on, but the chances that it will succeed. Ford and Volkswagen have been partners in the past. They were in a venture in the 90s called Auto Latina down in South America. It dissolved. It wasn't a big success. We know, many of us in this market, what Daimler and Chrysler was like. I covered it. I lived in Germany. I lived that thing for 4 years. The Germans don't play well with others. And as a general rule in this industry, they see themselves as the top of the heap. And if you're going to be in a partnership, you have to be partners. And I'm a little skeptical that that would work going forward. However, we are moving into a period in the industry where partnership, I think, is the new holy grail. You see it between the auto companies and Silicon Valley a lot. Smaller companies, you see General Motors acquiring what is now Cruise, GM Cruise Automation, because they're all coming to the realization that to get to the next level of auto 2.0 of autonomous vehicles and mobility, nobody, including Apple, including Google, has everything they need to realize it. And so they're looking for partners to make it happen.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alarm bells are being sounded by the Food and Drug Administration and the Surgeon General, talking about an epidemic of teen vaping. Even as cigarette smoking is dropping among middle and high school students, the rates of teens using e-cigarettes is soaring. Just one example for you. The Surgeon General says teen vaping is up 78% in just the past year. Dr. Richard Meek is a professor and principal investigator of the Monitoring the Future study at the University of Michigan. He has been studying teen substance use habits. So do you support use of that word epidemic?
Absolutely. Epidemic is actually a technical word in epidemiology, and it refers to any increase that is unexpected. So if you had a bubonic plague prevalence of just 1 in 1 million and it went up to 5 in 1 million, that actually would qualify as an epidemic. So if you take the technical meaning of the term, it definitely is an epidemic.
What strikes you most as you dig into all of these incidence figures that have come up of teens and vaping? What jumps out at you most?
Oh, well, that's easy. In 2018, we survey 8th, 10th, and 12th graders in the 48 contiguous states. Our survey consists of about 45,000 surveys every year. And what we saw was that the prevalence of nicotine vaping among 12th graders increased from 11% to 21%. So that's a 10% absolute increase. We've been doing this for 44 years, our survey, continuously, and that's the largest absolute increase we've ever seen in 43 years. And this is out of more than 1,000 increases in past 30-day use that we've observed. So it's quite substantial.
And yet, you know, here we know that we've seen this measurable drop in teen smoking tobacco cigarettes.
Yes.
Why do you think this same group is enthusiastically embracing e-cigs and vaping, especially the ones made by Juul and all of those flavors like cotton candy and mango? What's going on?
That's the billion-dollar question for the most part. I think you'd have to pay attention to the fact that Juul, which you mentioned, the most common vaping device used by teens, it's easily concealable. You can just put it in your pocket. There's no on and off switch. You just put it to your mouth and you suck in, and then the vapor arrives into your lungs. And so if you were going to smoke a cigarette, you'd have to, in school, find some place to go light up, and then you'd have to spend a considerable amount of time finishing off the cigarette. Whereas with Juul, you take a hit and you put it back in your pocket.
And Juul, correct me if I'm wrong, you can't regulate or dial down the delivery of this nicotine fluid, can you?
One pod of Juul mm-hmm. has about the equivalent of 20 cigarettes in terms of its nicotine use. It's actually, in many ways, equivalent or perhaps a little bit higher in terms of its nicotine concentration. And you're right, it only comes in one standardized form. You can't increase it or decrease it at all.
So who's behind this push to get these e-cigs into the hands of young people. And with that, I'm kind of wondering about the way, you know we have existing regulations for tobacco cigarettes that supposedly regulate advertising and sale. How is this product getting into these hands of kids?
Well, if you talk to the people who are in the vaping industry, they will say, oh, they're very much against kids using these vaping devices. And it just so happens that they're making billions of dollars, and they're not returning those billions of dollars either, right? They reap them in, and they use it to expand their business, and many of these vaping companies are now expanding internationally. So it would seem like, well, I guess nobody's responsible at all. However, if you want to take the tact, well, let's follow the money. Let's see who's profiting from this. I think that leads straight back to the vaping companies.
In fact, I know there was a big piece in the New York Times about the FDA accusing e-cig maker Juul and Altria, which is the nation's biggest producer of traditional cigarettes, saying, hey, you've backed off on your promises to keep these e-cigs away from minors. So we should just remind everybody, last fall, these companies said to the FDA, yes, we agree, pod-based products are a big driver of youth vaping, and they will address the youth vaping problem. And then we hear there's a new agreement giving Juul a great big increase in shelf space in stores where Altria is selling its traditional cigarettes like the Marlboros. So how do you think we keep these teen-friendly products out of the hands of teens?
Well, I think it's useful to look at the incentives here, right? So these companies that are profiting from teen use of vaping devices like Juul, for example, they wanted to raise revenue just a couple months ago. So in that process, you have to come up with a valuation for the company. And Juul was valued at $16 billion, actually, right? So there's a real incentive, not just for Juul, but for any vaping company. If you can go out there and you can get teens to use your product and get them addicted to nicotine, there's billions of dollars waiting for you. And right now, the response by the government has been, well, please don't do that again, but you can keep all the money that you made. And we're going to put up more obstacles to try to prevent this from happening in the future so that more teens do not become addicted to nicotine.
But meantime, so, we have a huge cohort who are.
Yes, right. So now, there's that, yeah. Right? And they put up obstacles to try to prevent that from happening in the future. So as you said, the FDA reached this agreement. It's not clear it's going to stick to prevent vaping companies from selling their products in convenience stores and gas stations. So any company that is able to navigate around those obstacles, right? Well, there's $1 billion waiting for you on the other end. So it seems like there's a real incentive for these vaping companies. And I feel quite confident that if the vaping companies couldn't make a profit off teen use of their products, if somehow there was a teen tax or something that you could estimate, it'd be very straightforward, what percentage of the revenue of these vaping companies comes from teen use. And if you required the companies to donate that to charity and say on top of that, that they were assessed a penalty, then I think teen vaping would plummet to near zero levels.
So policy discussions need to be made and advanced along that. I'm with Dr. Richard Miyakuza, professor and principal investigator of the Monitoring the Future study at the University of Michigan, as we look at the dramatic spike in teen vaping. Speaking of the FDA, it will be holding a hearing on January 19th to talk about what do we do to help teens kick the vaping habit. As we said, it's you're getting big, big doses of highly addictive nicotine. What do we know about the best way to do that? Because I'm wondering, is helping a 14-year-old or a 17-year-old kick a nicotine habit the same as helping a 45-year-old kick it?
It's all new uncharted territory at this point, and I think we can probably look at cessation strategies that have been successful for adults and maybe try to modify those specifically for teens who have been using Juuls. But I think there's a lot of unanswered questions at this point.
Boy, and when you want to talk about trying to get the word to these kids, this is dangerous. This is not the risk-free fun thing, the cotton candy-flavored pod that you think is so fun. What do you think is missing in the don't use this push toward kids?
Well, the vaping industry has really pushed the idea that vaping is less dangerous than cigarettes, which is true. But at the same time, it's hard to imagine any commercial product that's more dangerous than cigarettes. If there were such a product and the people who regularly use the product, half of them died, I think it would be illegal to sell that in the United States. So this message has come through very clearly, I think, to teens that vaping is less dangerous than cigarettes. But that's a very low standard. I don't think of anything. I can't think of anything that isn't less dangerous than cigarettes. Nevertheless, the message seems to be that, oh, this is harmless. It's not going to have any negative impact on your health. But I think one of the main risks of vaping is addiction, as you've mentioned. And also, there have been many studies that suggest that vaping leads to cigarette smoking.
What further questions do you have? What are you going to watch for from the FDA, from the Surgeon General, and from these e-cigarette companies?
Yeah, well, that's an excellent question. I'll tell you what I'm really interested in. The silver lining to this epidemic of nicotine vaping is that it's a natural experiment in a way. And if vaping does lead to smoking, which is considered one of the most dangerous consequences of vaping, then next year we should see an increase in cigarette smoking, which we haven't seen for 20 years. And that would certainly ring a lot of alarm bells.
And what kind of action do you think that might trigger? Would that be government? Would that be messages, public health campaigns to who? To parents? To the kids? What's needed, do you think?
Well, you know, the tobacco sentiment was very successful. That was in the late 1990s. That's when we see the beginning of this gradual two-decade decline in cigarette smoking. They got together for the tobacco sentiment, and they figured out, how are we going to stop teens from smoking cigarettes? And if we had something like that for vaping and e-cigarettes, it has high potential to be very successful.
Lots to keep our eye on. Dr. Richard Miak is a professor and principal investigator of the Monitoring the Future study at the University of Michigan. And hopefully we've prompted some maybe some heartfelt conversations in homes around the state.
I hope so. Thank you for having me.
Still to come, Motown celebrates its 60th birthday this week, and we're going back to where it all began. That's in 10 minutes. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Dan Gilbert has been a driving force in transforming downtown Detroit. His bedrock Detroit owns more than 90 downtown properties. Now a Detroit Free Press investigation finds Bedrock's used its considerable clout to strong-arm safety inspectors from the Michigan Occupational Safety and Health Administration. That clout earned Bedrock a rare meeting in the governor's office and has had a chilling effect on state oversight of safety at Bedrock properties. Here now is Detroit Free Press reporter Jennifer Dixon, and let's start with the very first question that you pose in your story. Did Dan Gilbert's development company get special treatment from the governor's office?
Well, according to the head of MIOSHA, it was the only meeting he's had with in the governor's office in his 2 years as director. So it was unusual, at least in terms of during his tenure.
All right. So we're starting out in 2016 with inspectors from MIOSHA, the Michigan Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and they come in and do an inspection at the David Stott Building in downtown Detroit, which Bedrock had bought and was renovating. So tell us what happened.
Well, the inspector came in, did an inspection. He found five different contractors on the job site. He cited all five of them. He found four contractors plus Bedrock on the site. He cited all five of those companies. Four of the companies chose to reach informal settlements, which meant they were entitled to a 50% reduction in their penalties. MIOSHA reduced the penalties for three of those four companies by 50%. It dropped the violations and the penalties against the fourth company, and Bedrock contested the violations initially. MIOSHA upheld those violations, so then Bedrock contested them again, and in that case, they prevailed.
All right. So walk us through what Bedrock did after it was cited then in late 2016.
So after it was cited, it obviously fought the violations with MIOSHA. Then it requested in April of 17 a meeting in the governor's office, which then took place in May of 17. A week after that meeting in the governor's office, MIOSHA invited Bedrock executives who were at that meeting to a meeting with the safety inspectors at the state office building in Detroit. The state called this refresher training for the inspectors, and half a dozen or so inspectors were summoned to this meeting at Cadillac Place, and according to state employees familiar with the meeting, Bedrock executives conducted the meeting at the front of the room and told the inspectors that a policy on construction work sites did not apply to them.
So basically, Bedrock said we're off limits.
Correct. And the Free Press asked the U.S. Department of Labor Chicago office whether this was appropriate. And I made the phone call as a reporter, and then the U.S. Department of Labor subsequently opened its own investigation into the handling of the Bedrock citations, and U.S. Department of Labor concluded that Bedrock did indeed make those comments to the inspectors.
Okay. And did these top Myosha managers stick up at all for these inspectors, the folks who are out, you know, in the street trying to make sure workers are safe?
According to our sources, the Myosha bosses did not speak up. Myosha argues that, yes, they did speak up in the meeting and that they also spoke up and spoke to the Bedrock executives after the meeting.
I know as I read your story, something that jumped out at me is that your sources said that a Myosha official actually scolded an inspector afterward for asking a question.
That is correct. That is what the sources told us. That same inspector who raised the questions in the meeting, he was subsequently cited for payroll violations, time card violations, but Myosha says it was that a sanction was unrelated to the inspector's questions during the meeting.
Jennifer, you write in your it's a great big investigative piece in the front page of the Free Press, and in it you write, it is not uncommon for employers to challenge safety citations, but Bedrock clearly took its opposition further.
Correct.
And what was their tone and what was the message that your sources say that Bedrock was pushing as it was doing that?
They were just pushing the fact that Bedrock's claim was that they are the owner of these buildings. They're not a general contractor, that they are not a general contractor, that they are what they called an owner representative.
So what does that mean?
Well, their argument is that as the owner representative, they don't have employees on the work site, that they have other contractors who control the work site, and that means they are not subject to Myosha citations.
Now, Jennifer, what are you hearing? What do sources have to say about how these inspectors felt about being lectured to? You use that term, being lectured by Bedrock executives and the supervisors saying nothing. How did that feel to people?
I think they felt betrayed by their bosses.
What did you find about other Myosha inspections, then, of Bedrock properties since that 2016 Stott building inspection?
Well, we found multiple inspections prior to the Stott meeting. We found 6 inspections of 14 employers working on Bedrock properties, 31 final violations, and $21,000 in penalties. In the 2 years after the Stott inspection, we found that Myosha has opened 3 inspections involving 4 employers, and they found 2 violations but have assessed no penalties.
And you point out something here in your piece, too, that this meeting in the governor's office, how rare is that?
Well, according to the head of Myosha, he had never had a meeting like that in his 2 years as director. We asked the governor's office if they had had other meetings about Myosha in the 8 years that Governor Snyder was a governor, but they declined to give us. They said that there had been previous meetings, but they declined to give us the names of the other employers that had been in the governor's office to discuss Myosha.
And since the governor's office is not subject to open records laws, you're unable to get a calendar of appointments. The public cannot get that information.
That is correct. So we couldn't independently verify the number of employers who had similar meetings.
So what have you heard from Bedrock since this story broke? I know you make a clear point in your story that you endeavored to speak with Bedrock, and that did not happen. So the story hits the Free Press. What have you heard from them?
Well, we heard back today. They issued a statement in which they said safety has been and always will be the top priority at all of Bedrock's work sites. Quote, there is nothing we take more seriously and prioritize more than the safety of construction workers on our site.
Could they point out any specific inaccuracies in your story, Jennifer?
They did not point out any specific inaccuracies, but they did say it paints a false narrative with numerous twisted facts, wrong assumptions, and general inaccuracies.
What about reaction from Myosha and the top management there? Any response from them?
I have not had a response from them today. I did have a conversation with them earlier this week, letting them know basically what we were going to say about the state, and we had a conversation then, but I haven't had a conversation with them since then.
Jennifer Dixon of the Detroit Free Press, her story is right there on the front page, quite an in-depth investigation posing the question, did Dan Gilbert's development company get special treatment from the office of former Governor Rick Snyder? Jennifer, thanks so much for speaking with us on Stateside today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Sixty years ago this week, January 12, 1959, a Detroit auto worker, former boxer, and part-time songwriter launched a company. He borrowed $800 from his family to get into the business of making records and publishing songs. That young entrepreneur was Berry Gordy Jr., and this is what he founded. Tamla Records, which the world knows as Motown. With us now is Robin Terry, CEO of the Motown Museum and the granddaughter of museum founder Esther Gordy Edwards. And Robin, that makes you Berry's great niece?
I'm his great niece. Yes, that's my great uncle.
And, you know, you stop and you think, what are the odds that this little label that Berry Gordy Jr. founded with that $800 loan from his family would have legions of fans from around the world 6 decades later?
Who knew 60 years ago, you know, that something that historical and magical was taking place, you know, right here in Detroit in a little house on the boulevard?
You know, we got to remind everybody, the Motown Museum is Hitsville. It's that famous little house at 2648 West Grand Boulevard where the music was made. And am I right, Berry and the family actually lived upstairs for a time?
Well, Berry Gordy lived there with his family, with his wife and young children at the time. In like 1959, 1960, the early years. And it was during those years that, you know, he was living upstairs and running his young music business out of what he called Studio A.
Robin, you see the visitors making what is very clearly a pilgrimage to that little house. What strikes you most when you talk to people and you hear about what they find in Motown music? What strikes you the most?
You know, it's really, I love that question because it's, you know, when you work at Motown, people always say, oh, it's so cool to work there. It's got to be really great. And you meet all these great people. But the truth is, it's the visitors. It's those people who daily come here from all over the world just to, A, say that they've been there, but to see where these musical icons that they've loved their whole lives, you know, got their start. It means so much to them to come to this authentic space to experience Motown. And no matter how many times when you work here, no matter how many times you go through it, every time a new visitor comes, it's a new connection. It's a new enthusiasm. It's a new excitement around, you know, what we're doing. For some, it's very, very personal, you know, when they come here. For others, they're so blown away by how modest, you know, the Hitsville house is, how small that little space is, and they're in awe that such a great sound came out of such a small space.
Why do you think that sound, all of those artists, all of those you know, indelible Motown hits, why do you think they still speak to people 6 decades later?
Well, you know what? I use what my uncle says about it. I mean, he was the visionary, you know, for Motown, for the Motown sound. And he was very clear about wanting to make music for all people, all colors of people. And it had to be music, you know, about real things. And no different than, you know, today, artists, as they create, they typically create and they're reflecting their own communities. They're reflecting the world as they see it. And so Motown, the Motown sound was written about real things, real emotions, real desires, real aspirations. And I think that it was such a human experience that it resonated with people, you know, all over the globe, all different cultures, because it was just about real things, true experiences.
And, you know, you stop and think, Robin Terry, we see black artists and business people, Jay-Z and Beyonce come to mind right away, who create music and control the business end of that. And we take it for granted now. But when Berry Gordy Jr. did that in 1959, he was breaking some major ground.
Absolutely. I mean, no question he was a pioneer in that space. And I'll tell you that, you know, all of the programs that we do, from our summer camps for kids, you know, to the adult programs like Amplify, Motown, my competitions, all of those we're constantly instilling in the campers, in the contestants, the importance of owning your brand and not just limiting what you do to being a creative, but really thinking about how, you know, that becomes business for you. And you see that in artists today, like Taylor Swift, like Beyonce and Jay-Z. I mean, it's, you know, you're seeing more of it today, but certainly Berry Gordy began that trend.
So what's the museum doing to mark the 60th birthday?
Oh, we're excited about the 60th. I mean, we have a dynamic year being planned, but most importantly for January 12th, that is the date that everybody is focused on because it's considered the birthday of Motown. And what it really is the date that Berry Gordy signed that promissory note that you talked about and got the infamous loan from his family savings club to start his first independent record project, which was a song called Come to Me by an artist named Marv Johnson. And once he was able to secure that financing, that was really the beginning of what became Motown Record Corporation, what we know today as Motown Record Corporation. So the world will celebrate January 12th, commemorate that day. What we're doing is launching a series called Our Archive Dive. And as you know, Motown Museum is expanding. And one of the reasons we're expanding is that we have a vast collection of Motown memorabilia. And a lot of it's never been seen before by our publics, because we have a limited footprint today. So we're using the 60th anniversary and these archive dives as a way to share with the public some of the treasures within our collection. And they're all facilitated by way of Facebook. And so visitors, friends from around the globe can log on and they can check out the archive dive. They're vignettes. Where they can see those original artifacts. And we'll do a series of these on key milestone dates throughout the 60-year anniversary. And the artifacts that will be included in the archive dive will be on display at the museum starting on Saturday, January 12th, and they'll be there for a month. So Detroiters, we invite Detroiters and Michiganders to come and get a chance to see them up close and in person.
Robin Terry, CEO of the Motown Museum, thank you so very much.
Thank you for having me.
One way to mark Motown's 60th birthday would be to explore a huge collection of previously unreleased music from Motown's archives. It's called Motown Unreleased 1968, 88 tracks, all from 1968, none of the songs available in any format until now. Some are from big Motown names, like Stevie Wonder's cover of I Left My Heart in San Francisco.
The morning fog made chill the air. I don't care, my love waits there.
Some are oddities, like actor Paul Peterson, the one-time Mouseketeer who played the son Jeff on TV's The Donna Reed Show. He recorded songs for Motown in 1968.
Baby, baby, what you trying to do? My heart's upset, my mind is too, and I can't stay another day. All the love you promised me was
Some are unknown artists who've covered hits done by big Motown names, like this, a group called The Utopians doing Smokey Robinson's I Second That Emotion. Motown unreleased 1968 volumes 1 and 2, now out on all digital platforms. And that's our Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.